What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning back in. Here is my second interview with Holocaust survivor and former prisoner of Auschwitz, Gene Klein. In this second interview, we discuss what it was like being liberated by the Red Army in 1945, as well as how the Holocaust has affected his faith and what it was like being reunited with his family. It was quite a pleasure. Once again, more of an honor than anything else. And I hope you find it fascinating. I know I did. And now, once again, I give you Gene Klein.
Okay. I am here once again with Gene Klein. Gene, thanks for coming back on the podcast.
Hi.
Hi. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you again. Thank you so much. I'll be fairly brisk. We had a phenomenal interview, I think, last time. Unfortunately, you had to go. I was hoping we could return then to your experience at Auschwitz, certainly. Perhaps we could start with what it was like the day that you were liberated by the Red Army.
I made a couple of friends from Poland because it was, you know, a good idea to have somebody to talk to. And there was absolutely no work in this place. It really was a concentration camp that took all the survivors from the surrounding slave labor camps. So there were thousands and thousands of us in this huge camp. And we just used to get a few hours of sleep because it was so horrible. Everybody just could hardly sleep because of the crying and the praying and everything else. And nobody knew anything about. We heard a lot of planes flying over, and we heard some cannon fire in the distance. But we had no idea what this meant, because basically we didn't know where we were. And so the three of us came out in the first thing in the morning, and it was the death rate, it was terrible, because they hardly fed you, and they were just didn't really care how many died, you know, from hunger and other sicknesses and everything else. And so we came out, and the first thing we noticed that their SS guard in the machine gun tower was missing. And, you know, every time something happens in the camp that is out of the everyday occurrence, we immediately have to, you know, talk about it and see, what does this mean that they are not in the machine gun? So they came up with the two answers. One is yes, and one is no. The yes is maybe because of the war noises were coming nearer and nearer, maybe they took off. Or B is that they are at the gate of the camp, all the SS guard, they're going to come in here and kill everybody. So they, you know, wouldn't be able to tell the horrors of this so-called life in the camps. And so we were sneaking around the big barracks until we could take a look at the gate. There was only one gate in and out of the camp. And we were sneaking around and peeking around the corner of the barracks to make sure that in case they are at the gate, they won't see us and shoot us possibly. And finally, we got to the place where we got a really good review of the gate, and there was nobody there. Absolutely. And the gate was closed, locked. with a chain, heavy chain, and a padlock, just so nobody can escape. Of course, we were first thinking of the negative possibility, which is that they're going to come in here and they just kill us because they don't want us to let the world to know what horrible situation we had to go through to live. So when we got to the gate, it was sort of a foggy morning, and we are just looking, and the camp was sort of on the top of a hill, so the fog sort of covered the lower part of this camp, you know. And we were just looking and couldn't figure out what is going on. We haven't seen an SS guard since the night before. And we are just starting there and waiting to see what's going to happen. And all of a sudden there was like a break in the fog, and we saw a horseman leading another horse, and they were, you know, pretty far away, so we didn't know what was happening, who was coming. And as soon as they came, he came, and a Russian soldier, immediately we realized that he has a red star on his hat, and he came to us, you know, he was on the outside of the gate, and we were on the inside. And the boys were Polish, so they are speaking Slavic languages, so they were able to find out who he was. And he said he is an advance guard. He was sent before all the Russians were advancing from the east, and they knew exactly where, not just the concentration camps were, but also the camps that were holding Russian soldiers captive. And they will have doctors coming and food coming and, you know, all the good stuff. And with that, he takes out his revolver and shoots the lock of the chain. But he says nobody can leave this camp, because there's so much horrible sicknesses, you know, from having lice on you for months, a lot of typhus and typhoid fever and stuff like that. So nobody can leave until they are examined. So we just took off. He was just standing guard outside waiting for the rest of the Russian soldiers advancing. And we were running all over the camp and just running into the barracks. And as many languages as we spoke, we started screaming and yelling, "We are free, we are free." And it was one of those things that you never forget, because those who had enough strength left, they came out of the barracks and they're running as fast as they can under their conditions to look at the gate and rush to talk to the Russian soldier. And those who were too weak crawled out of the place just to find out what was going on. So it was, we realized that we made it. And that was an extremely wonderful feeling, because it was exactly 1 year since my family was taken by the SS in Hungary, who basically be killed. The first stop in Auschwitz was the place where they separated you from those who will be going to the gas chamber and then to be burned in the crematoriums. And 20% will be sent to assorted slave labor camps all over the Nazis occupied forces. And basically, they were going to kill you through doing the work for them. And so it one of the things that you don't forget ever, and the joy, and also the fear that when you get home, your family won't be there because they were killed. I knew my father was killed in Auschwitz, yes. But I had no idea what happened to my mother and two sisters. So, sure enough, a lot of trucks are coming, Russian army trucks, and they set up examination places outside the camp. And then the next step is they have assorted medicines, and when you are examined by the doctors, they send a little note, you know, like you take to Publix to be filled. And it's actually just said, I had a typhus fever and some medication I was supposed to take. And I went over there and they gave me the pills. And they said, go over to the other end of this, you know, setup. And there are buses, and they're going to take you, because of your illness, they're going to take you to the nearest hospital. And so I said, okay, and I started going towards the buses, but I didn't get on them. I made a left turn, and I knew the sound of the trains coming from a certain direction, so I knew I had to go towards the east, because that's where the station should be, the same station where we arrived to this place. And so on the way, I noticed that they had little, you know, small houses where the SS families stayed. Few of the SS guards had their wives and children with them, and they had these bungalows for them. And of course, they were not there because they took off. You know, you could just hear so much, you know, cannon fire and planes flying overhead and all sorts of weapons being heard, that they wanted to get as far away from the camp as possible because they knew that if they find them, they will kill them. If not the Russians, then the inmates of the camp.
Yes.
And so I go into one of these houses, and I look in the closet, and there's all sorts of civilian clothing. They must have left in a big hurry, because everything was like somebody still lived there. And I go into the kitchen, and there is food in the pantry. And I go into the bathroom, and I turn on the water, and it's hot water. And I see these beautiful, fluffy towels, and I see soap and shampoo and everything else. And I take off my raggedy uniform, and I must have done some sort of dance on it in my, you know, in my joy at being free again and alive. And I took my first shower in 1 year, nice hot water, and washed my hair, and just was wonderful. And as soon as I dried myself, I picked out some civilian clothing that fit me, so they must have had a teenage boy, and got some food out of the pantry, put in my pocket. And I decided to go out to the station and wait for the train to take me home. And lots of trains were coming, but the wrong direction. They're going towards the front, and they have all sorts of armaments and tanks and Russian soldiers, both male and female. So the Eastern Front was still fighting the Nazis. And we were told that no matter which direction you're going to go home, there will be food and medicine and doctors at all the stations. You know, the war was still going on, so this wasn't like a train that ran on schedule.
Right.
And I was about halfway home, and somebody taps me on my shoulder, and I turn around, and it's a young lady who was obviously a prisoner. She still had her blue and white striped dress on her, and she was really thin. And she looks at me, and she says, "Aren't you Klein Gubby? You're an Hungarian." She recognized me, and it turned out that this young lady was a good friend of my older sister, Lily. And next thing she says to me, "I got good news for you. Your mother and two sisters were with me in an ammunition factory working for the Nazis. And they are alive because they were closer to the Western Front. So the Allies liberated them. But my mother was in pretty bad shape, so she had to stay in the hospital. So they stayed with her, of course, my two sisters. And I continued my journey home, very, very happy that, you know, four of the five of us survived, which was astronomical. You know, if one person came back from a family, that yeah. was already a miracle. And I got home. I found the future husband of my sister Lily, who happened to be working on the Russian front for Hungarians, you know, for the Hungarian army, because they were fighting together with the Germans to fight the Russians. Of course, that was the best part of the whole war, I think, because that was the end of the Nazis. You know, in invading Russia was a fatal mistake, but it was good for us. And so we were waiting, the young man who would marry my sister. We went out daily to the station, and after a few days, my mother and two sisters arrived, and it was big joy. When they looked at me, they sort of had this idea that my father, who was basically a strong, muscular young man, not old, that he will survive, and I, as a skinny teenager, would perish. But it was just the other way around, and I had the job of telling the sad story about my father's death in the gas chamber. And it was just, you know, awful to think that just because you are a religion, you would have to be killed by people who hate you. And that was basically it. It was exactly 1 year from the time that I arrived in Auschwitz until I was liberated.
Wow.
So, you know, a lot of, in Auschwitz, a lot of other prisoners from other parts of Europe were in the camps like 2-3 years. And after I was liberated, I couldn't understand how they could actually survive that much time.
Right.
And if it wasn't for that civilian German engineer who gave me part of his food for 2 weeks, so I was able to rebuild my strength, not knowing how much longer this horror would last. You know, that was about 6 or 7 months into my imprisonment, and I was in pretty bad shape.
Yeah.
But this food that he gave me, I was able to rebuild myself. And also it was an interesting feeling, because here is a person who is German, who actually took a great chance, because if he were seen by an SS guard giving food to a Jewish prisoner he could have wound up in the same camp I was in,
yes,
or worse. So that was, in a way, I felt that not everybody is horrible. Mm-hmm. That they are, no matter where you are in the world, there are good people and bad people, and hopefully you will be dealing with good people for the rest of my life.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-218-6010. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-218-6010. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-218-6010.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Yes, it's extraordinary, Gina. I really appreciate you taking the time to go through that. It puts me in mind, as you were talking, Gene, about faith. Obviously, you went through a period of just unconscionable pain and hell, right? And I wonder what that does to one's faith. I mean, I think of, there was that quote that was supposedly written on the wall of a concentration camp. If there is a God, he will have to beg my forgiveness, right? And I presume you're familiar with Viktor Frankl and Man's Search for Meaning as well.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. So that would like me, I'd love to ask you the question, how did the Holocaust, living in the post-Holocaust world, influence your faith? Can you say whether it strengthened or weakened it?
Weakened it.
Weakened it.
I got to the point that, you know, I was bar mitzvah at 13, you know, good Jewish boy going to temple with my family on holidays and, you know, Saturdays, Friday nights. And we kept kosher house and, you know, we were good Jews, let's put it that way. But at the same time, you know, I got to the point, like, how can God let something like this happen to so-called his people?
Mm.
I mean, 6 million from babies to grandparents were killed for nothing else except because of their religion. And it's just really, I just basically gave up my religion. I didn't keep the holidays, and, you know, I'm not doing this in spite. It was just some of the things that you never thought that could happen to you.
Mm.
And to me, especially because of my religion. And, you know, a lot of people in the camp became more religious, and other people became less, you know. It was just depends on what was happening in their lives.
Right. No, understood. Thank you, Gene. I kind of moving on then, when did you decide to begin speaking about the Holocaust? I know I'm going to paraphrase. I believe you wrote about Eli Weissel that while he began to speak about it straight away, you gave it some time. You didn't commit to speaking about the Holocaust right away. And I was just curious, what made you decide to speak about it?
Well, actually what happened was I was in Miami, and in, I think, Fort Lauderdale, there was a Jewish survivors kind of office, and they asked all the survivors to register because they were going to ask for help from different organizations. Of course, it did work out a little bit later, they started, organizations started to deal with Germany and their big, big industrial people, because there were quite a few of these factories who opened up just outside Auschwitz, and they were using the prisoners from Auschwitz for their, you know, 24 hours a day, 12-hour shifts, day and night. Doesn't matter. If you die, they will replace you with other prisoners from Auschwitz. So they really owed a lot of money to Jews who really, you know, practically died, some of them, by having to work so hard. And wow. Florida is one of the states that is mandatory to, during the history lessons, to talk about the Holocaust. And I got a phone call from a high school, and before I spoke anywhere, you know. And they said, we are having a Parents' Day on such and such date, and we heard that you were a survivor, and we would love to have you come and speak, because the students are studying now about the Holocaust. So I said, what can I lose? I'll go. So sure. I went and I spoke, and, you know, I don't know how old I was, but I realized that they were about the same age as I was when I was taken away from home, you know. So it really was interesting to see how they paid such an attention to my presentation, because all of a sudden it dawned on them that this, something like this could happen to them, how terrible it would be, you know, yes, just because of their religion, you know. And so the parents were there, and mostly Jewish, because their kids were in this class. And they came over after I was finished, and they just, you know, stood around me, and they said, you have got to do this. I said, what? Speak. Nobody knows how terrible the Holocaust was. You know, they go to temples, go to churches, et cetera, go to schools mostly. So I started speaking in different places. And then Jill, she just encouraged me to speak, because I was so good at it and was able to try to make sense of the whole horror that was happening. And I started, you know, speaking at churches and synagogues and all sorts of organizations, religious or not. Later on, I started speaking for big corporations about my, you know, experiences as a 16-year-old kid,
yeah,
under those circumstances. And then Jill's book came out, and some cases we were able to speak together, and that was really great. Now, the last time we did that was, I was in their office in New York talking to them, and I was invited to Denver to speak their annual, you know, big convention.
Sure.
But so, it was really interesting, because I went to their headquarters in New York with Jill, because we had some other gigs to do in New York. And we were speaking in one of the big, big temples in Westchester. And, okay, so let's see, what would be any other questions that you are interested in. Yes. First of all, I want to tell you that you will get as much as possible as far as information about my family from Jill's book. I mean, it is just fantastic. And the DVD that I sent has one of my speeches, just to, so you get an idea of how what it involved. And it's it was interesting because it was in the library, and it was a real mixed crowd, and good questions and answers, and they really greatly enjoyed. You know, it's very hard to say enjoyed because you could really can't enjoy listening to something like that. But
they,
a lot of them never had an idea that something like that actually happened.
Right. No, understood, Gene. Yeah, for our audience, Gene here has been kind enough to send me a copy of the book as well as a DVD of a speech that he gave, which I anxiously look forward to. Look forward to receiving. Yes, Gene, I have just a couple questions left, and then I'll, yes, sir. So I'm curious about, are you able to say what you thought of humanity in general at the end of the Holocaust? I got to imagine you became, I'm not trying to be funny, but I got to imagine you became slightly pessimistic about humanity towards the end of it.
Yes. Yes. The only thing that helped in a positive way was the incident that happened with that civilian engineer.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
And that was really, really helped a lot.
Last question, Gene. As a result of all that you experienced, both, you know, during and since the Holocaust, and with what you know about this world, are you optimistic about our future as a species, as human beings?
No. No. It's, you know, I'm very pessimistic because several countries in this world is keep going further to the right. And, you know, unfortunately, we are one of the people that there's a lot of hate coming in our direction. You know,
yes.
A lot of them hate the blacks. A lot of them hate anybody who is a different color. They hate people coming into their countries trying to save their lives. And in at home, you know, in the U.S., it's totally amazing what one hateful idiot did in a couple of years.
Yes.
And I hope that we have enough people with brains that they won't let it happen. If it has to be going out and standing in line to vote in freezing cold or whatever, have to do it, because if they get in, you get the notion now from the right that they think that this is the Messiah. You know, they lost their brain cells listening to this guy and the things that he basically, that's the reason several of the Fox News, you know, resigning to that, but they are just urging people to believe what all the lies are, you know.
Yes.
And it's just, I really am very pessimistic.
I can understand. Well, Gene Klein, this was a pleasure. This was an honor. I'll think about talking with you these couple hours for the rest of my life. Thank you so much for taking the time for me.
Thank you for calling me.
All right.
And
thank you.
Have a good day.
Thank you. You too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on eyewitness history, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.